Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is Pandor Haji, Deputy Administrator for Business Programs. And with us, we have Roger Klerfeld, who is the Director of the National Appeals Division, and his Deputy Director, James T. Murray. Many of you may not know this, but back before I ever came to Business Programs, I was with Farmers Home, and I actually worked for what was then known as the National Appeals Staff. So I know the value that the appeals process carries for us in making sure our decisions are just, because that's what we're all about, is making honest, equitable, and fair decisions that give the applicants the services they're requesting. So this is going to be a great training opportunity for all of us. I know we have a lot of questions about appeals sometimes and how the appeal process works, how the review process works, and some of the decisions being made. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and let the Appeals Division get started with their presentation. Michelle is working just as voraciously as she can to get the live meeting up so that we can have the visual presentation along with the audio portion, but we can't waste any more time, so we're proceeding. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the Appeals Division.
Thank you, Pender. I want to tell you what we're going to do today. I'm going to spend some time talking about how Congress set up the National Appeals Division and what we do in our process. And then Jim is going to talk about how to present your case in a hearing so that you will win. So in some sense, his presentation may be more important to you than my presentation. The National Appeals Division started in the general reorganization of USDA in 1994. That's when Congress reorganized our department
back to FMHA days.
Okay, can you mute your phones out there because we're getting a lot of feedback from you, please? Thank you.
And at that time, what Congress decided to do was take all the appeal shops in the agencies that service farmers and move them to a centralized appeal shop. This has been done in a lot of states where there's a central appeals staff at the state level. And in 1994, Congress moved it and required appeals be done at the National Appeals Division for the Farm Service Agency, Risk Management, NRCS, and Rural Development. And so that is sort of the scope of what we handle. One of the things I wanted to go, and if you have the PowerPoint, I'm moving on to the second slide. One of the ground rules here is that I don't want to talk about any cases that are currently pending. We have about 600 to 700 cases pending at any one time. There is, in the statute, prohibition against ex parte communications. And that means that I can't talk to you without having the appellant there on any matter that is on the merits of a proceeding. So I can talk to you, or you can call up a hearing officer and talk about process and procedures and, you know, when is the hearing scheduled or things of that sort. That doesn't entail ex parte communications, but you can start jabbering about the merits of a case to anyone in the National Appeals Division. That prohibition extends to the General Counsel's office as well. The only person who can jabber at me about the merits of a case is the Secretary, and I'll get into that in a little while. Now, on the next slide in the PowerPoint demonstration is my discussion of why appeal to NAB. And for the appellant, there are a number of reasons why. It allows the appellant to understand what has happened to the appellant, why he was turned down, and provides him an opportunity to present additional evidence. And I'll get into that issue further on. But for agencies, it's also a good reason to have appeals. It affords an opportunity to find out why your customer is unhappy with what you did to him. Many times it's like being at a restaurant. The restaurant would rather hear what they did wrong than just lose a customer. and let a disgruntled customer walk out the door. It allows the agency to explain the basis for the decision. It allows the agency to tell the person why they were treated the same way everyone else was. Many times, that's all people are looking for, is that they were treated in a similar manner to others. It allows the agency to get new information. So if you turn down an application because it didn't include photographs, it allows the person to provide photographs in the appeal process. And, of course, finally, the agency is in a better position if it's taken to court. And that is because when there's an administrative appeal process, judges have a different standard to follow, and the agency has a much easier time of prevailing than if there is no administrative appeal. So when I train my hearing officers, I go into the values that we hold as an organization. One of them is transparency. We do everything in public. All our decisions are posted on the internet. We do not talk to a farmer or a participant without the agency people there. We don't talk to the agency people without the farmer or participant there. Everything is very transparent. I try to tell them that what they need to do is listen and learn to each side of the dispute. Now, you should remember that agency personnel will have their view of what happened, and the participant will have its view. And who knows which one is correct or not correct. We try to instill fairness to all participants, including agency reps, so that everyone thinks that they've been heard and that the decision-making is reasonable and proper. And finally, we talk about reaching the right decision for the right reason. That without getting to the right decision, an appeals process isn't really important. Now, the appeals process is part of the safety net that participants have in dealing with the agency. What we check is to make sure that the agency follows its regulations and its guidelines. We don't create any of those for the agency. We also want to demonstrate the fairness of the appeals process so that someone goes away, even if they lose, and says, I was listened to, and I understand why the decision was made that way. Many times when people don't have lawyers, that's difficult for people to make those distinctions. But many people do. We give a customer survey to every appellant who comes through our shop after their case is done. And on many of them, we get comments like, I was treated fairly, I don't like the result, but I understand it. Remember, on the next slide, why should a participant appeal to that? Now, if he doesn't appeal, he has to do whatever the agency's decision was, pay back money, lose a guarantee, or whatever. If you appeal, for RD last year, appellants won 36% of the time. That also means that the agency won two-thirds of the time. Now, most people, when I give them those numbers, say, well, is that good or bad? And the answer is, I don't know if that's good or bad. Obviously, the fewer cases the agency loses, the better it looks for the agency. But there are always going to be a subset of cases that you're going to lose because you're extending the envelope, you're pushing the envelope. There's ambiguity in some of the agencies tend to lose more cases when a program is brand new, and as the ambiguities get worked out through policy changes, the number of cases that they lose goes down. And you can see that throughout time. If you take a look at the next slide, it says favorable outcome rate, and by favorable outcome, I mean when the agency withdraws its adverse decision and says we'll do it over, or when we rule against the agency. And in 2011, for RD decisions, it was 36.6% of the time participants won their appeal. But if you look at 2009, it was 40%. Now, with the new Farm Bill coming out and new programs being put into place with new regulations, that number is probably going to go back up. Because, as I said before, there are more ambiguities when a new program comes in. And once those ambiguities get worked out, the agency's decision-making becomes better. And so they win more of their appeals. But I want to take a moment to go through the statute that was passed in 1994 and talk about how we're organized and why the process works the way it does. Because there are lots of statutory requirements for the appeals process. I'm going to start with me, the NAD director. There's a requirement that there be a director of NAD appointed by the secretary from among people who have substantial experience in administrative law. For 20 years prior to being appointed the NAD director in June of 2002, I was the assistant director of appeals for the Energy Department next door to our downtown South Building. I'm appointed for a 6-year term of office, and I was appointed initially in June of 2002, and I'm eligible for reappointment according to the statute. I was reappointed in June of 2008, and my current office expires in June of 2014. I'm not subject to removal during that time, and I can't be transferred out of the NAD directorship. So that insulates me in making decisions on behalf of corporations. The statute also says that no person other than the secretary can direct or control what I do. And that includes undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, and whoever. But it also says that the secretary may not delegate that authority to anyone else. So if you want me to do something, you have to go get the secretary or me to agree to it. You know, and under the department's regulations, I'm one of the 18 general officers of the department. Now, the statute also requires the secretary to maintain an independent national appeals division headquartered in Alexandria, where we have about 20 to 25 people, with three regional offices, the east located in Indianapolis, the south located in Memphis, and the west located in Denver. That's where most of the filings get done. They create the filings and send it out to hearing officers. Hearing officers, we have about 45 scattered around the country, mainly in rural areas, and I'll get into that in a minute. And they report to the regional offices. I have a staff of 8 people in Washington. They do administrative director reviews, and they just write them for Jim. We provided you with a map of where our hearing offices are located, as well as hearing sites. We have hearing sites within 200 miles of every farmer in the United States. And we have in our case processing system a system where if we put in the zip code of the appellant, it will tell us the 5 closest hearing officers as well as the 5 closest hearing sites to that farm. And I'll tell you why that's important in a minute. So I want to go through a few common definitions so you can understand where we're coming from. Okay? The first one is an adverse decision. Agencies make adverse decisions all the time, and then they make decisions that are not adverse to a participant. And that is something that everyone needs to understand. According to the statute, adverse decision means an administrative decision by an RD employee that is adverse to a participant. And that means a particular individual. So if you turn down an application that's adverse to a participant, if he asks you for something and you say no, that's adverse to him. Okay. An appellant is a participant who appeals an adverse decision. And then what is a participant? The statute leaves it up to the secretary to decide who's a participant. And the secretary's decision in the late 90s said that a participant is defined very broadly. And that includes anyone who receives or has a right to receive a payment loan, loan guarantee, or other benefit. A little broader than some other federal agencies have defined participants. Some agencies have defined it in a way where only once you're in a program are you a participant. Are you the Department of Agriculture has defined it so that when you turn down for a program, then you can appeal that as well. Secretary has done that in management. And nothing agencies do in their regulations can alter the definition of participant. So there have been attempts, I won't name names, by some agencies to limit who can file an appeal, and those are ineffective. And why are they ineffective? They're ineffective because the Secretary may not delegate to the heads of agencies the direction and control of what NAD does. And so no agency administrator has the right to direct and control who can appeal and who can't appeal. So it's really a question of what's in NAD's rules that where the Secretary has decided who the participant is. And in fact, in 1999 when that was done, it was the General Counsel's office who decided to do it that way. So let's turn now to the obligations and the duties of agencies in this matter. That statute says no later than 10 working days after making an adverse decision, like I'm not going to approve this application, the Secretary shall provide the participant with written notice of such adverse decision. So you have 2 weeks to provide a letter or whatever to the participant saying, I'm turning you down for whatever reason or you can't do X. And you must include the rights available to a participant to appeal to the National Appeals Division. Okay? So what are those rights? Person has the right to appeal an adverse decision and seek an evidentiary hearing in front of a hearing officer, provided they do it, ask for a hearing within 30 days of receiving notice of the decision. Okay. It is important that you provide that notice to participants. Here's why. Courts have universally ruled that if agencies do not provide the proper notice, that is, you can appeal it, and you have 30 days to appeal it. Those two things. That the agency cannot prevent the person from filing an appeal years later. In one case recently, a court of appeals allowed someone to file an appeal 12 years late because the agency failed to tell him he could file an administrative appeal. So it is to the agency's advantage to provide that notice because it creates finality. Once the 30 days are finished and a person doesn't appeal, you know it's done. If you don't provide the notice, it's open-ended. And I will tell you that courts of appeals have held 6 years is not too late to file an administrative appeal. 12 years in one case because the agency neglected to tell the person they could file an appeal within 30 days. So I urge you for your own benefit to provide that notice to people. It is to your advantage to do so. Notice also that there is nothing that says that you can provide a notice that says you can't appeal. What the statute says is they have a statutory right to appeal, and the agency must provide notice of that statutory right. So when you talk about it as giving appeal rights to someone, that's not really technically true. What you're doing is providing notice of a statutory right to appeal. Congress gave them the right to appeal. And if you think of it in those terms, you won't make the mistake of saying, well, you owe us $1 million back and you can't appeal that. we have seen letters from agencies where they've said exactly that. Now, you know intuitively that if the government demands some money from you, you can appeal it somewhere. If you get a traffic ticket and they want $100 from you, you can go to traffic court and explain yourself. You intuitively know that. So don't get caught in the trap of saying that something can't be appealed if it's adverse to the person, and particularly if you're trying to take money away from it. The next slide talks about appealabilities and goes into how we look at it when someone tries to appeal your decision that something's not appealable. Now, they cannot appeal one of your rules, your regulations, your policies, but they can appeal how it's applied to their factual situation. And so, also please remember that if it's clear the person's going to lose, that doesn't mean they can't come in and jabber at one of my hearing officers. So the fact that the person doesn't have a good case is somewhat irrelevant to whether he can go through the appeals process. And all too often, some of my own people sort of truncate it because they know, well, this person's going to lose. Well, they still have a right to talk to a hearing officer and get a decision out of us. Now, last year, of the appeals we had on whether you can appeal, we reversed the agency 93% of the time. And I want to point out that almost all of them are based on the first statement in this PowerPoint of why appealability decisions are reversed. And that is, while the underlying rule may not be challenged in that, the application of that rule to a particular person is appealable. So you might issue a rule that applies to everyone in the country, but when you apply it to a particular participant and say, we're going to turn down your grant, that's appealable. If they have a score that you scored against criteria and the person says, I don't like the criteria you're using, that's not appealable. But if he says, you misapplied those criteria to me, that is appealable. Okay? So we had a case, different agency, where someone claimed that the contractor for the agency misapplied the application because he missed two or three pages of the application in finding what the score was. And lo and behold, it was true. So the person had to, basically have to go back and do it again. Our analysis focuses on what the individual wants to appeal. If it is how the rules were applied to him,
so we're getting some background music from somebody's phone. This place is on hold, so please mute your phones. Maureen, just maybe you can send an email to everybody, because if they're muted, they probably can't hear what I'm saying.
That's what I was going to do, Pandora.
Thank you.
Hold on.
Well, also.
So we have a separate process where people can come in and say, is this appealable? And in 93% of the time, we say, yes, it is. That process is a lot of day. The agency doesn't know about it. And we favor providing the hearing the statute provides to people. So our record is pretty skimpy when we do that. We recognize that. So agencies can still challenge whether it was an adverse decision before the hearing officer, and in several cases, hearing officers have reversed our initial determination that the decision was appealable. So I encourage you not to sort of forget that you can always argue to a hearing officer that the decision should not be at NAC. So I've broken down the appealability decision rates for you. As I said, 93% in the last 5 years have been reversed. in my office, but only 81% were reversed for RD. So RD is doing a better job of it. I've broken it down to the three services in RD, give you a feel. Most of our appeals, as you see further on, are from the Rural Housing Service. But utilities comes in occasionally, and RBCS comes in the middle somewhere. But let's say RBCS, if you represent them, 9 out of 10 were reversed in the last 5 years. So let's now talk a little bit about what happens during the hearing process and why it runs the way it runs. And Jim, after I complete my comments, we'll get into more details about how to present the case to a hearing officer. But I just want to give an overview of why it works the way it does. And most of it is grounded in the statute, Congress's direction to us. Appellants have a right to a hearing within 45 days of filing an appeal, which means that we do a pre-hearing conference about 20 days in, and we ask you to provide an administrative record in a very short period of time, 17 to 20 days, so that people can see it before the pre-hearing conference and talk intelligently at that conference. I know that's rough. If the record is very big, talk to the hearing officer, see if you can work out a different schedule. This is not cast in stone. We want to be fair to both sides. But we do need the agency record. It is not to your benefit to skimp on the agency record. We've seen a number of cases where agencies lose because they don't put in the proper documents into an agency record, and I'll talk a little bit about that more. Appellants have a right to a face-to-face hearing in their state of residence. That's why my hearing offices are scattered around the country for travel purposes. Several years ago, we had 50 farmers who wanted face-to-face hearings in American Samoa, and we had to send hearing officers out there to hold 50 hearings. We do hearings in Alaska where we have no hearing officers, Puerto Rico. There is a statutory right to a face-to-face hearing with a hearing officer. Now, that does not mean that the agency rep has to be in the same room. The agency can attend by phone. If I were the agency rep, I would consider what the issues are before deciding whether to be there in person or be there on the phone. I think there's some advantage to being there face-to-face so you can get feedback and see how your response is being dealt with by the hearing officer. But the hearing officer has to go travel to the appellant, and that's why we have hearing sites within 200 miles of every farmer in the United States. The appellant, although he has a right to a face-to-face hearing, may agree to have it on by telephone or just a review of the documents. That right is not with the agency. And so if the farmer says, I want a face-to-face hearing, my hearing officer moves to the farmer in their state of residence. Let's talk a little bit about the agency record. The statute says that the director and hearing officers shall have access to the case record of an adverse decision. And they define, the statute defines case record as all materials maintained by the secretary related to the adverse decision. I want to point out that that doesn't mean all the records that support the decision made by the agency. It means all the records that pertain or relate to the adverse decision, all the stuff that you looked at, even if it doesn't support your decision. Right? So what happens to all this information you give hearing officers? The statute says that the hearing officer is not bound by the findings made by the agency. So if you decide that something exists and the appellant can provide additional information to say it doesn't exist. So we're not bound by the findings made by the agency. Now, the statute always says, and this is a problem with agency people, and I understand why, that the hearing officer shall consider information presented at the hearing without regard to whether the evidence was presented to the agency when it made its decision. What that means is that you can find new information being presented that should have been presented to you, but wasn't, and that we must consider it. And so we may find your decision erroneous based on this new information that you didn't even know about. And why that may cause a little angst, but as they say, get over it. That's the way it is. That's how Congress set it up. It's not something that I have control over. So Congress also decreed that the appellant had the burden of proving that the adverse decision was wrong. Okay, we all know that. Now, new evidence at the hearing can meet that burden. For example, I have the question of whether an application was filed on time. The UPS receipt showed that it was filed a day late, but there was testimony at the hearing that the UPS machines date stamped it incorrectly. And so it was found in the hearing the application was on time. That's just the way it is. It's sent back to you, and you have to deal with the application then. Well, let's talk about the process that a hearing officer will go through. Our hearing officers have the authority to subpoena witnesses and documents and to administer oaths and affirmations. That means that if someone lies at a hearing, they're subject to the penalties of perjury, which is 5 years in prison or fines of $10,000 or both. An appellant or an agency may request a subpoena. But I also want to point out that under USDA's regulations, the agency representative can authorize any employee to testify without the issuance of a subpoena. And I would urge you that if an employee has personal, first-hand knowledge of facts, as opposed to what they think your rules mean, that you just make them available rather than requiring a subpoena. It will look better to do that. We don't really care what your rural development person in a particular state or county thinks what the rules mean. They mean what Washington says they mean through their handbooks and policy determinations. And if we were to rely on local people for that, we would get multiple answers to those questions, and we can't deal with that. Once a hearing officer closes the record, either on the day of the hearing or allows people to submit additional information, it's 30 days in which to issue a decision. I'm proud to announce that that happens almost all the time. The hearing officer is required, if an appellant provides new information that the agency has not seen before, the hearing officer is required to leave the record open a reasonable amount of time to have the agency comment on it or submit competing evidence. And if you get in that situation, by all means, ask for whatever time you need to come in and try to refute or rebut the evidence presented by the appellant. Even though the agency doesn't have the burden of proof, it does have the burden to rebut evidence presented by the appellant. If you don't do that, you do so at your peril, because that's sufficient evidence for a hearing officer to find that that is true, and therefore the agency's decision was wrong. So I encourage you to submit additional information that says that the appellant is not, evidence is not really accurate. If the determination is not reviewed by me, The hearing officer's decision is a final decision that the appellant can bring to court and that the agency must implement within 30 days. So once a hearing officer issues a decision, we have a system where it's published on the internet within 48 hours, and an electronic notification goes out to about half of the appellants plus agency. Only if they've given us their email address do they get electronic notification. Appellant has 30 days to the hearing officer's decision to seek my review of that determination. If someone files for direct review, the hearing officer decision is off the table. There's no longer the final decision of NAD and does not have to be implemented by the agency. Agencies only have 15 business days or 3 weeks to request direct review. They don't have 30 days. Why is that? I don't know. That's what the statute says. Have to go back to Congress to change that. To me, it doesn't make any sense, but I wasn't here then. The statute says that the head of the agency must request direct review, but our regulations say that only the head can do it, so that the deputy head can't do it unless he's in an acting capacity, as acting administrator. I think that was designed mainly so that there was some control in Washington over what could go up to the director and get a decision out of that. And again, I wasn't here at that time. And there's no interlocutory review of rulings. So if the hearing officer doesn't allow evidence into a hearing, you cannot appeal that to me. You just have to grin and bear it until the hearing officer issues his decision, and then you can complain about it. So what about the director's decision? Well, I can uphold, reverse, or modify a hearing officer's decision. I can also remand it, and occasionally we remand it if there's some factual development that needs to be done. I'm supposed to issue a decision within 30 business days after receipt from an appellant, or 10 business days after receipt from an agency. Now, in all honesty, if you ask for a direct review, you're not going to get a decision in 10 business days. Most of the time, when an agency does that, there are boxes of records to look at. Not only do we have to do that, I require my staff to listen to the hearing, even if it's 3, 4, or 5 days long. And we cannot simply take in all that information, figure out what to do, write up a decision, issue it in 10 business days. So we're going to try to meet that, but the reality is that's way too short. We do meet the 30 business days for appellants in most cases. Again, sometimes, particularly an RMA case, there might be 6 boxes, Xerox size boxes of records. Someone has to look them over. I provided a slide on a map showing the workload for RD in the last 5 years. And we get about 1,300 cases from RD a year, a little over that. And the map shows you where those cases come from. And remember that a large percentage of that are rural housing cases. And so that's why Maine shows up as giving us a lot of cases. Florida, Arizona, Southern California shows up. And in the big Midwest, in Nebraska, Texas, Kansas area, there are large areas where we don't get any cases. But this is all for RD. This is not for RMA, NRCS, or FSA. I've given you a breakdown of those cases of how many show up from single-family housing. Out of 6,300, 5,900 are from rural single-family housing. And you'll see that rural business cooperatives had 49 cases, you know, over 5 years. I mean, that's peanuts compared to how many actual adverse decisions you guys make. And, you know, shouldn't be worried about that, frankly. Because that's the tail on the dog, if you will. Well, that completes my prepared remarks. I'm going to turn it over now to Jim. He's going to take you through the appeal process and how to organize yourself so that you have a better chance of winning your appeal.
Hi, I'm Jim Murray, and you should have the slides or the information in front of you about what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to kind of go through it. Roger said it best at the end there. At the beginning, he said I was going to tell you how you can win your case. But I'm going to tell you how you have the best chance of doing that. Can't guarantee what's going to happen at the hearing. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. An appeal hearing process starts when a participant files an appeal, or might not actually be an appeal. It might be one of the appealabilities that he talked about that we determine is it appealable or is it not appealable. If we determine it's not appealable, that's the end of the whole case right there. It's over. If we determine it's appealable, we give them information about, we'll contact them about treating it as an appeal, and it goes through the appeal process. The regional office, they've already received it either as an appealability or as an appeal, and they assign it to a particular hearing officer based on a lot of factors. Where is it? Who's available at the time? Those sorts of things. At that point, the case record is created. Stuff starts coming into the file that's going to be the case record. And that sends a notice to all the parties about the appeal. Meanwhile, while that's happening, the hearing officer receives the case record from the regional office. They schedule a hearing and a pre-hearing. The pre-hearing is always by telephone, virtually always by telephone. And the hearing officer conducts a pre-hearing with the parties. Now, the pre-hearing is one of the most important parts of this whole process before we get to the hearing. The next slide shows a notice of appeal and request for agency record. And one of the most important things about that is that I talked about the NAD information sheet, and you should read that NAD information sheet. If you're not already familiar with it, you should know what it says. It's got a lot of information. It's an addition to what I'm going to say here, and also kind of a snapshot or a brief overview of everything you need to know about the beginning of the hearing process. So it's important to look at it when you get it. You may just get it with all the paperwork and not look at it or anything because you think you already know all that stuff. Well, maybe you do. I don't know. But you should at least look at it, make sure you're doing things, because we still get hearings where people try to put, I don't know, soil into the record as evidence and those kind of things. And that sheet would tell you, well, take a picture of it or get testimony or get a written document, but we're not going to take soil. There you go. Thank you. All right. That brings us to the pre-hearing. Why do we do pre-hearings? That's one of the most important things you can do. Pre-hearings are important because they can help resolve important issues before you get to a hearing. Maybe some of the issues will be knocked off of the table. There'll be some agreements about some things. They also provide information to the parties or third parties or other people that might be involved in the process. A lot of farmers are only going to be involved in this process, or homeowners, or they're only going to be involved in this process one time, so they need a lot of information about the process. People that come to the hearing as representatives, I don't know how often that happens, but they're going to have a lot more familiarity with the process. So, you know, it's to provide everybody, so everybody knows what's going on with the process to make it run smoother. And also, there might be pre-hearing issues that we need to decide. Roger mentioned that, there was an appealability, but maybe the agency brings that up again at the pre-hearing before you get to a hearing as well. There's more information now, and this is why it's really not appealable, or that sort of thing. It could, or maybe it wasn't filed in time and it went through the process of being filed timely. So there could be pre-hearing issues that people could bring up then rather than go through a full-blown hearing and maybe have to travel places to do the hearing. So the hearing officers, I got a lot of work to do at the pre-hearing conference. And of course, they're going to do all the things that they would normally do, just like if they were hearing. It'll be recorded, and they'll identify everything about the case, the case number, the date, tell the participants that it's being recorded. They'll get an acknowledgement from the participants that it's being recorded. They'll have everybody introduce each other, so everybody at the pre-hearing conference knows what's going on. Typically, it would be just the parties who have appealed and probably one representative from RD or whatever agency is in that hearing. And then I'll start asking questions like, are there any third parties or interested parties that need to be contacted about this? As Roger also pointed out, there was a case where somebody didn't get notice, and so a case came up years later and somebody was able to appeal it. Same thing could happen with third parties if they're not notified of this proceeding, given an opportunity to participate. They wouldn't be bound by whatever the ruling is in the case, and so years later they could file a separate appeal or something. So that's a key process. So the agency representative should be aware of this too, and if they know of anybody, they need to bring it up and get it all out there. It doesn't help anyone to leave somebody out of the process who could then bring up a very similar case later and have to relitigate the whole thing all over again. And everybody needs to look at what's there, verify that they have a complete copy of the agency record, and that they all agree that they do have a complete copy. And at the pre-hearing conference, they can look at that and compare notes and make sure that they all have what they're supposed to have. And a big thing they do is identify and frame what the real issues are. There's going to be an appeal by an appellant who's going to state what the issues are. Agency's going to have a position on what they think the issues are. And they're going to have input before the hearing officer as to what they believe the issues are. The hearing officer is actually going to have to be the one that says, I have an appeal, I have a decision, this is what the real issues are in the case. But the parties need to talk about that at the pre-hearing conference to try to, resolve those issues. You don't want the agency representative presenting evidence on what they think the issue is and the appellant presenting evidence on what they think the issue is. And the two don't meet. So you want to make sure everybody's on the same page. Another important thing is to tell the parties the nature of the evidence that may be presented at the hearing. As I said, there's an ad information sheet that gives you some information about it, but, you need to know if you're going to submit a DVD at the hearing. That's probably not going to be played at the hearing, because there's probably not going to be equipment to do that and those sort of things. Make sure you don't bring in, 2-foot by 3-foot posters of something you want to show somebody. I mean, if you want to bring it to the hearing, that's fine, but have a photograph of it to put into evidence, that sort of thing. Because it's 8.5 by 11 file, and everything kind of needs to fit in there. And everything doesn't fit in there. That's why we have photographs of things and other ways to get that into evidence. I once did a hearing where somebody tried to put in a 20-foot monitoring well into evidence. Didn't work too well. But. Another thing is the hearing officer is going to do is try to encourage stipulations of fact and get parties to agree on what's undisputed in a case. Sometimes the parties are adverse to each other. You have the appellants feeling that they weren't treated fairly by the agency, so it might not be as easy to do as it sounds, but that should always, everybody should do that, because they're better off focusing all your energy on what you really need to talk about at the hearing rather than talking about specious issues or rebutting issues that don't have anything to do with the ultimate decision you're trying to get to in the case. And of course, up front, you're gonna try to find out about accommodations, need for translators, anything like that that's going to be needed at the hearing. Is it going to be in person? Is it going to be by telephone? Is it going to be a record review? All those kind of things. And if you need something special, arrangements will be made so that they can be, if it's going to be an in-person hearing, or even if it's not, that it can be. That stuff can be all gotten there and together and ready in time of the hearing. The hearing officer is also going to tell everybody, we publish all this on the internet, you can see it there. They're going to tell them about all the other stuff they can get at NAD's website. Now, try to get an email address from both parties. Agency, that's easy. Not so much for appellants. Once you do have web pages, websites or internet access, don't really, a lot of them just don't want it, they don't want to get it electronically, so that's fine. Because the official version is the written one, so, but we do try to get that in this modern day and age. Especially cases involving rural development. I mean, it's rural, so a lot of people don't have that kind of access that they might like to have anyway, but a lot of people just don't like to get it out. They don't want the government to have as little bit of information about them as they can, I think. That brings us to the hearing. Okay. As a general rule, NAD hearings are open to the public. And anybody can come, but non-parties can't usually participate in any way unless they just happen to be a witness or something for the case. They can participate. And if the appellant objects to the presence of anybody in there, the hearing officer will have to weigh that and consider the objection and determine whether the individual can remain or whether the hearing has to remain open or whether a portion of it has to be closed or something. That doesn't come up very often. Of course, a third party or interested party can't be excluded from a hearing despite an appellant's objection. One of the things that could happen at this time has to do with the witnesses, sequestration of witnesses. This doesn't happen very much at NAD hearings, but fact witnesses can always be sequestered. So maybe the hearing officer or one of the parties will want the witnesses sequestered so that they're so that they don't hear what the testimony is from other people in the hearing, to kind of make sure everybody's talking from their own memory and not what somebody else might have said. Not that they're going to lie, but you know that they don't want that bleed over from what maybe somebody else said. So. And anybody can be sequestered except maybe an expert witness who's going to testify based on what other people testify, or the agency representative. And when I say representative in this context, I don't mean the person presenting the case. The agency is allowed to have a person there who's their representative. Sometimes appellants don't get this, but there's the representative presenting the case, and then there's somebody who's like the agency's person there to assist that person. They can, of course, remain in the hearing, but even if other people can't necessarily, and they might not like that, for instance, a lot of times we'll get a husband and wife will come in, and the appeal is in the name of maybe some company, or it's just in the husband's name. Well, if there was a sequestration order, maybe the wife couldn't stay. If she's going to testify, if she's not going to testify, or they're not going to testify, it doesn't really matter who's there, but only if these people might testify in case they could be sequestered. Control of the hearing. That's important to the hearing officer because keeping the hearing controlled and regulated so that everybody speaks when they're supposed to speak and nobody speaks out of turn and that sort of thing is going to enable them to be in the best position to get the correct facts they need to get and delve into the most relevant matters at issue. So the hearing officer will direct everybody and he'll give them instructions at the beginning of the hearing. Just like he did at the pre-hearing conference, he'll tell them about how things are going to go. He'll tell people, you know, don't interrupt when somebody else is presenting. We don't want arguments over the evidence. The hearing officer will rule. And the hearing officer will carefully tell each party, everybody at the hearing, what stage of the proceeding they're in. He'll explain it at the outset of the hearing. They'll say, now we're done with opening statements, so we're going to move on to the evidence phase, and the appellant will go first. And now that everybody's done, we're now at the closing stage, and people can give closing arguments or closing statements. The hearing officer will give everybody an oath or affirmation. Mostly they give affirmations now. That's usually done nowadays, I think, more because some religions and cultures won't swear to anything, so they just give an affirmation. There's no difference in what you're agreeing to do, which is tell the truth, and whether it's an oath or an affirmation, if somebody doesn't tell the truth, they could be subject to penalties for not telling the truth. All the hearings are recorded, just like the pre-hearing conference, the hearing is recorded, and that is an important part of the record in the case. And the hearing format is pretty typical. Hearing officer will give their opening statement. They'll have a statement that they go through, which is to tell everybody they're from NAD, what their role is in it, and those sorts of things. And then they'll tell the parties. The parties can give opening statements, and they'll probably explain what an opening statement is. Opening statement is not evidence, it's just a brief statement of what you think your case is about, kind of thing. And then almost always, the appellant who has the burden of proof will go first. They don't really have to, necessarily, but almost all the time, the appellant Dell will go first, and they'll begin presenting their case. And they'll go through their case, and witness by witness, and after each witness testifies, of course, the agency representative can ask them questions, which is cross-examination. And then there can be rebuttal. And this can go on a couple of times with rebuttal. It really shouldn't go on too long, but it happens in these cases that rebuttal goes in. And after both of the parties have said what they need to say, then the hearing officer might have some questions, because the hearing officer's got to make a record for their job. Each party's got their own position they want to stake out. They only want to maybe talk about what they think they need to talk about in their case, but the hearing officer may believe that he or she needs more information to round out their record of the case and their understanding of the issues and what's going on in the case, so they'll ask their own questions. And then at the end, everybody can sum up and adjourn the hearing and close the record. Now, we're going to move on to preparing for the hearing and those sorts of things, and the resources you might need to do that, hopefully you know most of them, but there's the NAD website, which is www.nad.usa.gov. There's all kinds of statutes. What access you have to statutes and that sort of thing, but the statutes are out there. There's a NAD guide online at their website.
The Verizon Wireless. The wireless customer you called is not available at this time. Please try your call again later. Announcement 1, switch 1-8-8.
Look, also regulations out there if you can have access to them, but you can see other determinations. They're not strictly precedential, but they will tell you, first off, the agency or NAD can't be arbitrary and capricious, so if there's a line of cases saying certain issue, they should be kind of similar, so you might want to look at those and help you prepare your case. So that's kind of the hearing process. But the hearing process actually starts well before you ever get to the hearing, and that's with when you first start dealing with people in the process. So you got to build that record early. You have conversations with people, make notes, confirmation letters if you need to, sign and date as much things as you can. Log calls, if you can do that, etc. Have a signing log when people come into your office, if you can do that. You can't always do all those things, but the more those kind of things you can do, the more you can corroborate what you might need to corroborate. For instance, somebody testifies that, well, I came to the office June 15th and talked to Joe who told me this. Well, if you have a log, if you're fortunate enough to have that, and it says nobody was, that person didn't come to the office that day, or Joe wasn't at work that day, or whatever, those are important. That's important information, because you might not have a witness that knows whether the person talked to Joe or didn't talk to Joe. Maybe Joe's not there anymore, or maybe Joe says, I deal with dozens of people every week. I don't remember talking to this person. So that could be very helpful in convincing the hearing officer whether they should believe that person or not believe that person. Keep copies of any notification letters you send out to people. This is done most of the time, but it's common sense. You should do it. If there are handbook or notice provisions that were applied at the time, make sure you keep those, keep them with the file. When you do an adverse decision, make it complete, clear, and concise. Stick to the point, stick to the issue you need to stick to, and cover all the issues that went into the adverse decision. Yeah, servicing was proper, this was proper, this was proper, therefore we're going to do Y with your case. And so make sure you do that. Another important thing about the case could be, you decide whether you need some kind of help with the case, legal advice or other advice. For instance, you got a case that involves very high dollar amounts. I don't know what the access is out there, but you might want to talk to OGC, somebody to see if maybe they want to get involved in the case or could offer some advice on this case because it's a lot of money involved at stake and you don't want to mess up the case. Or there might be technical people. How was that study done in that multifamily housing use? Who are those people that did that? What are their credentials? And that sort of thing. Was it look at what the regulations say about those kind of studies and make sure you did it correctly and that sort of thing. Get the right people from the beginning, I guess, what's important. Know what you need to do and start at the beginning with the right kind of people you need to have involved in your case. You need to figure out whoever made the decision, you're the representative. I'm talking to you as a representative, so figure out where the decision maker is coming from. What's the standard that's going to be applied in this case? What does the hearing officer need to believe to find in your favor? In other words, you need to know what the elements are in the case. In other words, if a regulation says you need to do four things in order to accelerate a loan, well, then you need to make sure you did all four things in order to accelerate a loan, and you have evidence that you did those four things. And be realistic in your assessment of your case. Sometimes parties tend to think that they're going to win every case, so they're not as realistic about their own chances of winning as they might be. I mean, you might have a marginal case. Well, no, if it's a marginal case. You think you're right, but you recognize that there may be holes in your case that, you know, that somebody else could look at and say, well, you know, there's holes in this case. This case might not go the way you want. And that way you're not surprised by things or that sort of thing. Or you can take steps you need to bolster your case. And finally, develop the record. Make sure you got a good agency record there. Make sure you just supply everything you're supposed to supply. Make a list of exhibits. Try not to be redundant, but make sure you have everything you need. If something is already part of the record, when you get to evidence, you don't need to put that in again. You might need to refer to it at the hearing. It's this document, this page, this tab, whatever you need to do, but you don't need to put it in there more than once. We see that happens in a lot of cases. There's a lot of the same information here. File this thick, but it only contains 15 pages that are important. But so a foot thick file of 15 pages. There's probably stuff in there that doesn't need to be in there. I'm not saying shortcut yourself. Make sure you have what you need, but if you see a lot of redundancies in there, you really don't need to put them in again. But the thing you should have in there so everybody can see them is the regulations, any handbook provisions you looked at, and any notices that are important to this case. And consider, in complicated cases, making a chart. Maybe somebody's had a lot of servicing to their account or something, and it's very confused. Maybe a chart would help. I don't know if it would help. Not that hard to do in this day and age with computers, but maybe you could make some kind of chart that shows this happened on this date, and that date. Anything that's going to make it easier for the hearing officer to be able to understand what you're trying to present to them and put that in context with the regulations they're trying to apply. I guess the next most important thing to do is keep control of your case. All right, you got your record. If you're going over your case and it looks like you didn't do what you were supposed to do, consider withdrawal if you find that you didn't follow all the procedures or you think you did, but you don't have evidence to support that you did. You know, start over again if you have to. But you know, don't just go ahead and lose the case. First of all, that's a lot of extra work for everybody involved, the appellant as well as the agency. If you go ahead with the case, lose the case, somebody tells you, and then somebody asks for direct review, and months later you got to do it all over again. So you're better off if you notice there are problems and say, all right, we'll just start over. We'll rescind that notice and start over again. Also consider whether settlement, in which you get some of what you want, it's going to be better than taking a chance with a hearing officer who will give you zero. I mean, that's the difference between settling or mediation or something and going to a hearing. When you settle, everybody usually gets something out of a case. When it goes to a hearing, the hearing officer usually picks. You know, somebody wins, somebody loses. That's usually what happens. And reasons you might settle or you got questions about your own evidence in the case. You think you'd win, but you're not sure. Some of the reasons to settle are you want to avoid future problems. Maybe this is an issue that hasn't been thoroughly thought out through the agency yet and how to really apply these rules, and you don't want to go ahead with a case that's going to have a decision out there that says this is what this rule means. You know, sets it in kind of stone. Like I said, not precedential, but it's the final agency decision. So it would be arbitrary and capricious for NAD to say something different about that same rule in the future unless there are other many different factors involved. So maybe you say, today isn't the day we want to go forward with this particular case. We'll settle it. We'll let them do X, and we'll get something out of it and that sort of thing. Remember, this is going to go on the Internet. Like I said, it's not presidential, but it could do a lot of things. It could encourage other people to appeal, and it also puts it out there as to what NAD's ruling is on a particular issue. So those are reasons that you might want to think about the case and settle it rather than going to a hearing. And to go back to basics, like I said, identify the regulations and definitions, point them out to the hearing officer, identify whatever policy it is being served. There might be a statute that's ahead of all these regulations and notices, and it might state policy in there. So you might want to point that out to the hearing officer.
policy is to maintain multifamily housing units in rural communities or whatever that happens to be and why you're doing what you're doing. Test your assumptions. Consider whether you're assuming that you don't need evidence for some things that everybody knows. Well, one of the problems is we're the government and appellants are not. So acronyms, you might want to stay away from acronyms when you're, at least when you're talking about them initially in the hearing. So that, the hearing officer will probably know. The hearing officer might not know if they haven't done that particular kind of case before or when, the new farm bill comes in and there's a whole new set of acronyms that nobody knows what they mean. But so try not to use them. And if you do use them, at least explain what they mean first and then use them. That way, and don't just assume everybody knows what you know about the case. That's a big flaw with people who present cases. Hearing officer only knows what's in the record. Regardless of what you think the hearing officer might have in their head or might know, they only know officially what's in that record, and that's what they're going to rely on when making the decision they make. Be succinct, but be complete. I can't point this out. Outline your position in a few points. Make those points and then quit. Don't beat a dead horse. More is not necessarily better. Don't get bogged down in minutiae. Rebut or argue only about relevant material or disputed facts and evidence. And an appellant may bring up things that maybe the hearing officer has already sustained an objection to, or maybe you know are just not relevant to the outcome in this case. You don't feel the need to go over every single one of those multiple times. Every time they bring it up, you bring it up, that sort of thing. I mean, you want to make an argument about it, it's not relevant, it's not pertinent, that's fine, move on. That tends to keep the hearing going on for a lot longer than it needs to go, because you rebut that and they rebut it, and everybody's rebutting everybody's rebuttals, so it keeps things going for a long time. And as I said earlier, know the weaknesses of your case. Appellant has the burden of proof, but the agency has the burden of going forward. That means the onus is on a party to refute or explain evidence in a case. If appellant testifies to A, if nobody says A didn't happen or disputes that A happened or goes back to record keeping can help that, actual testimony can help that, but first of all, if you look to see, is it corroborated or contradicted already? And remember, the appellant's testimony is evidence. You may not think it's very good evidence because you don't believe them, because you've dealt with them or whatever, but it is evidence. And if it's not rebutted or if it's not rendered not credible by some other reason, I was in the office on June 15th, here's our sign-in log, no, you didn't come in that day, or you didn't speak to Joe because Joe didn't work that day. That's, you need to rebut that evidence. You can't just ignore it. You have to take some kind of step to deal with that evidence. And when I say that, I mean you got to put evidence on to rebut that evidence. Don't just argue that you shouldn't believe the guy or argue that, well, we always do it. We never tell people that kind of stuff. That's fine. If you've got a witness, someone would say, well, this is what I tell people. I read from the paper. This is what I told you. That's fine. But just arguing, argument is not evidence. It's that simple. So arguing that, we didn't do it that way, what he said. It's not really rebutting what that person had to say. You need something that would lead the hearing officer to believe that the person who said that or that evidence is that's not credible and should not be believed. Your evidence is more credible than theirs. And don't ignore the other side's arguments. Like I said, you don't need to keep beat a dead horse, but acknowledge them and explain why they shouldn't win. Move on. You don't need to keep doing that multiple times, but you need to address each argument that they raise, at least if it's close to relevant. You need to deal with it, try to rebut it, and move on with your case. And what's the most important thing to remember? Well, there's a lot of important things. Know the facts in your case and present them clearly. That's pretty important. Explain how the regulations apply to the facts. That's pretty important. Anticipating the appellant's case, that's always a good one to do. Think, what would I say if I was the appellant and wanted to win this case? Know your own case. Know all the ins and outs of it, how it applies. All those things are pretty important, but the most important thing is to be nice. It's never helpful. It's never going to help your case to make the hearing officer angry, okay? So always be nice. Try to be polite. Be civil at the hearing. You may not like what's going on, but try to be professional and civil at the hearing. Don't make the hearing officer angry. That's the end of my presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Purcell and Mr. Murray. We will now have comments from Mr. Andy Jamalowicz. Andy?
Thank you, David. I have really nothing much to add to what's been presented. I think it was an exceptional job. There's excellent information that was presented to you today. But great. I think that who's out there administrating over some of our programs, first thing they have to do is know your program, the regulation, instructions, and the NOFA that went out for that program. Be diligent in your reviews of all applications. When drafting the adverse decision letters, be certain to put in all the reasons that an application may have been deemed ineligible, not just it may be one major one, but put all of those in there. It will definitely help your case on in case something is overruled. Again, can't help but reiterate the retention of documents, relevant documents to these cases, maintain a file, particularly if you're thinking something may occur. And lastly, check in with the national office staff on any appeals. I think that helps ensure that we get consistent responses to similar issues. We may have encountered something there, so just give the program person or myself or Chad Parker a call and talk to us about that. And again, I'm sounding like a broken record here, but if you do have to go to a NAT appeal, is be prepared and be synced with your documentation and be complete. And again, after sitting through a few of these myself, is stay focused on the facts and issues of the case. These can often be, kind of contentious and in many cases emotional. And it's just, really encourage you just to be professional, remain composure. And as Mr. Murray said, be very nice to your hearing officer. So, thank you, David.
Thank you.
Can I add something to Andy's comments? This is Roger Corfa. We know we come in at NAT, we come in into a dispute at the tail end of the dispute. We know that you've been dealing with someone for sometimes years over something, and you may be upset with how he's treated you, but it doesn't help anyone for you to show that or for you to take that to a hearing. This is just a situation where there's a process set up. We need to get through the process, and we realize that you may be angry, and how could anyone think that this person is telling the truth? But the answer, as Jim said, is that we're restricted to the record that we have in front of us. We're not here to find the truth, necessarily. We're here to say what we believe happened based on the record we have in front of us. And we realize that some people are very hard to deal with. There are people who are very hard for us to deal with. So the idea of trying to control your emotions and be nice to not only the hearing officer, but the appellant as well, is good advice.
With that said, we will now open up the lines for any questions and answers that the field staff may have. So if you have any questions of the director or the deputy, please speak clearly and present your questions at this time.
David, Fred Pijak, I've got a question for the director. This is not related to this process, but to your prior experience at the DOE. I have been under the impression, that's a general question, you'll enjoy action, that DOE handles grants differently, and they make their selections, but they're not subject to the same appeals process or perhaps not subject to appeal. Could you clarify my misconception of this? Because apparently they do have appeals.
Well, let me start off by saying that I haven't been at the Department of Energy for 10 years now. So I don't know how they're currently handling it. In days of yore, there used to be a grant appeals office, and that was part of the Board of Contract Appeals, handled appeals of grants. But they handle it not as the Board of Contract Appeals, but as a grant appeals Sixth Creek delegated to the Secretary. Now, the Board of Contract Appeals was within the Office of Hearings and Appeals, where I was the assistant director. So, and of course, as you know, in 2007, all boards of contract appeals, including the Agriculture Board of Contract Appeals, was combined with the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals, working on a GSA. So they don't normally get into grants anymore, so I don't know how the Energy Department is now dealing with grants. But let me add to this. We go back to the initial grant of jurisdiction in the statute, 1994 statute. When there's an adverse decision by someone in RG, it's appealable to NAD. And as of a couple of years ago, there was a United States Supreme Court case which said that agencies lack the ability to limit that kind of jurisdiction. So even if USDA wanted to change that, it would have to go back to Congress to change it. It could not change it by regulation.
Okay, well, a couple more questions, loosely on adverse decision. I take it that if somebody were to submit an application, but they didn't fill out anything, and it were denied, that would be an adverse decision, or perhaps even if they inquired about a program and said that they were told, well, you know, you're not a small business. This is only for people that grow oranges and apples. You grow peanuts. Is that kind of deniability also possibly something that is appealable, or am I just worrying way too much on that?
Well, the answer I have is it's likely to be appealable. And it's particularly true because you phrased it in terms of a factual dispute between the agency and the appellant about whether they are eligible to participate in a program. And as I said earlier, the agency has defined participants to include people who think that they can apply to the program. Other departments in the federal government have defined it to rule those people out. So we have not.
And I just want to say also, it really has nothing to do with whether they have a viable case at all. It's whether there's a factual dispute as to application of regulations in their situation. Sometimes they'll write in and say there isn't a factual dispute. I just think it's wrong, and we'll get that as an appealability. And we'll say, well, that's not appeal. You know, but sometimes it's more ambiguous. Like you said, they say, well, you know, they're wrong in what they're saying about why I shouldn't be in the program. Well, we don't know if they're wrong or not wrong, so therefore that would be appealable. May not be a very tough case to decide, but that would be something that would go to a hearing and get decided.
Well, those are academic questions, but let me give you some questions that are not before the board, I'd like a little further information. In one case in particular, we stipulate who is going to be conducting an expert review. They are recognized to have expertise by the Secretary, by the EPA, in the statute. But the individuals, when and if, it's sort of infrequently, if they come into an appeal situation, into a hearing, they don't really want to give their name out. They want to protect their anonymity. And I've been told by NAD that is not possible. Is there any way that an expert witness can give testimony without being identified, without compromising their anonymity, which they hold to be rather dear? Because it does compromise their potential participation.
I guess my first question would be, why are they considered an expert witness? See, an expert witness is somebody that has particular training, knowledge, and expertise. How are you going to know that unless you know who they are and whether they have particular training, knowledge, and expertise?
Jim, if we could identify them as in the EPA X-STAR program, having done hundreds of reviews of a particular technology and so on and so forth, stipulate as to what their expertise is. Is there any way of shielding their anonymity?
Well, my without talking about any specific case, because that was
not a specific case before the...
My reaction is that you have to get the other side to stipulate that that person's an expert. You can't stipulate to your own expert.
Well, I think that would be on the
And so if the other side...
Oh, my point. Yes,
the other side would stipulate that this person is an expert, it wouldn't matter. And it wouldn't matter. It's very unlikely in litigation that the other side will stipulate unless it's clear that the person's resume is bulletproof. On the other hand, if there's a rule that says that someone with X, Y, and Z experience is an expert, qualifies as an expert, if you can demonstrate X, Y, and Z experience, then I don't see any challenge that can be made. However, it's hard to do that in the context of some anonymous window.
Where Fred's going with this is the agency's kept review officials confidential because obviously sometimes the cases go into multiple review levels before decisions render. And more than likely when an appeal takes place, and the review officials are disclosed, the anonymity is lost. So I think it's been the position that obviously they have to disclose themselves if they're going to participate in the appeal.
I mean, it seems to me that the only way that you can possibly rely on that witness, let's say that an appellant brings in his own witness, okay? You can use your witness to rebut him, or you can cross-examine his witness, but you have to in some way refute what his witness says. And I don't think you can do that through anonymous statements.
Yeah, especially typically what would happen with an expert, somebody would know ahead of time who the expert was and what their credentials were. And so how am I going to check to see if somebody's got a degree in hydrogeology from Texas Tech if I don't know their name, for instance? I don't know what the kind of information technical expertise they would need, but that sort of thing would come up. All right, I want to check this guy out. Did he really go there? Did he really write that paper? Who is it? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's why it makes it so tough, you know.
Yeah. And I just bring it up because our technical reviewers who on a few occasions have had to be witnesses for us have asked us to see if they can be shielded from having to review their names. They're very sensitive about that. It hasn't happened very much, and they've never really been shot down, but I was just wondering about that.
You know, my general assumption, and it comes in the context of, you know, people filing complaints against things that happen in the government, is that if you're not willing to stand up and say what you want to say, I give it very little weight.
From another point of view, too, though, from an agency standpoint, if that was the agency's decision to use these review officials, the agency should be willing to offer that person a testimony if they feel it's relevant to their case. Obviously, if you relied on that technical review to make a decision, that's relevant to the case.
Right. I mean, another program where we had a panel of reviewers on the biomass, the grants, I don't know that any of those were ever appealed, actually. But there, the results of the panel and the way the reviews are conducted, you can know who the reviewers were, but how that actual review was compiled, that's blind. So.
Are there any on the Internet? Yeah, no questions on the Internet?
Years ago, we had requests when we were doing guaranteed loans that our customer is the lender and our correspondence is directed to the lender. The decision is rendered and given to the lender. And in the past, we've had cases where both parties had to initiate a request for an appeal. We've seen in some cases that hasn't always happened. Has that policy changed with that or in the statute? Because, years ago, we've seen cases where maybe the lender feels they don't want to dispute the decision of the agent.
Correct.
So how is that happen?
I think we decided a long time ago that the bank is not a necessary party to the appeal, that the farmer can, in fact, appeal that.
And in a case where the application is actually made by the lender, that would obviously not be the case. I think.
The lender is an applicant in the guarantee loan.
And I don't want to argue or dispute issues.
We understand, and we're participating in that link.
David initially asked about whether they can do away with guarantees or withdraw them, and of course the answer is yes, under the rule that you have proposed or under what the contract says. Last month, the Supreme Court ruled in a case that a contract with the government is binding on the contract, on the government, and that even if you don't have enough money to pay the person, you still have to, they can still take you to court and get an order to pay them. So the answer is government contracts are binding on the government. And if you provide in the contract a way to get out through negligent servicing or something of that sort, then yes, the answer is if it's negligent servicing, you can get out of it. So it's important to put all that stuff into the contract.
That's why our lender's agreement is a contract between the lender and an agent. You made some points about publishing the decision on the internet. Is the whole decision identifying all the parties?
Yeah,
no, so that's redacted.
Sorry, redacted.
Sorry, redacted. It's got the case number, so you could follow
it
that way.
That's it.
Legally, that's probably not required, but we don't do it that way. People don't want to see their name.
No, certainly.
We also redact location information. So we don't say this is in Kansas City, Kansas.
All right.
In a few cases, you might find out what state or county it's in, the nature of it, but generally that stuff takes a while. Now, to be honest about it, the person's neighbors probably can figure out who it is.
Oh, sure.
No one else can.
Yeah. You know, years ago, we were also identified in instructions of what's not appealable. Does that still hold? Or I know you made a case most of the time. If they're going to ask for an appeal, they'll you probably. And where I'm going with this is, for instance, our program, the rural, and we have to first and foremost be located in an eligible rural community. And so obviously, if a project is not in an eligible area, in past we used to tell our state directives that that's not an appealable issue. I could see a person feeling, have an adverse opinion of that. But in reality, the location of the project has to be specific.
Well, those facts are undisputed. That would not ultimately be appealable. But the question of what you should tell somebody as to whether it's appealable is a separate issue.
So maybe as direction to the state, do we even tell them it's not an appealable issue in our decision memo, or do we just leave the appealable portion out, or what?
Well, I've been doing this for 30 years, and until I got the USDA, I never heard of this issue of what's an appealable issue, because usually an agency makes a decision, they say, that's our decision, if you don't like it, appeal it, and you take it to the next step in the process, who decides whether it's appealable, whether that happens here, but it usually happens because an agency tells somebody it's not appealable, and they disagree with that, and then they don't file an appeal, they just go to NED and say, tell me if it's appealable, and if it is, then maybe I'll follow the appeal. So it's like an extra step, and I understand that might be some cases at the beginning for the agency. But some cases aren't so clear-cut, and that's the real problem. I mean, it's clear that somebody's not in the eligibility area, and we've had appealabilities like that. Somebody says, I know I'm not in the area, but my neighbor lives two blocks away and got it, and so I think I should get it. We're going to tell them that's not appealable. But the case where they say, yeah, I need criteria. I don't have a lot of money, and I live in a rural area. I think I should get this loan, too, but I was turned down.
Well, we don't know enough about that case to know whether it's appealable. You might, so you can make some, so agencies make decisions about that. But this whole thing of an agency telling somebody it's not appealable is like foreign to me. So it's an unusual process. I've done it before.
Well, it happens all the time in the USDA. I understand that.
I have a question. I'm Tony Ashby, the Business and Industry Servicing Division. Yeah, I you had mentioned as far as additional information that can be added, and I just wanted to get some insight as far as how that would work. I mean, because then obviously the agency would be at a disadvantage, you know, if there was some information that was left out of an application. How would all that be weighed in on?
Well, let's say that you turn down an application because it doesn't include photographs, right, which recently happened. And during the appeal, the person supplies the photographs. Okay? If those photographs are relevant to the person getting the grant, we're going to reverse it and send it back to you to use those photographs.
Even if the notice required them to present that as a complete application.
That was my point. What I was going to say, I mean, if they have to have the application in by a certain deadline, then if they didn't have those photos or whatever like that, they didn't meet the deadline because they didn't have a complete application at that time.
Well, you could argue at some point that, all right, well, then we're changing our theory of the case to that it's a late application. I don't know, but the law says what it says, and we have to do what the law says. And that's an unusual, again, that's kind of an unusual wrinkle in USDA cases. That's just something that's unique to their specific statute. Most statutes are a snapshot. The program, are you eligible in this state? Time based on the information the agency has. That's not necessarily true with that. Listen to that statute, you know, it's just,
because then it would open up a lot of things where a lot of applicants would come back and say, oh, well, I didn't have a chance to submit that information in. You know, and then, you know, that could really create a domino effect.
Well, and what we hear from appellants is that they didn't know they had to submit the documents with the application. They thought they're just stating that fact would be sufficient. My response earlier was, get over it. You know, the Congress set it up. They're allowed to do it. The other group of people in appeals, in administrative appeals of the federal government, the other group of people who have the same right are veterans. Veterans can submit new information during the appeal process and get their case sent back for consideration.
Yeah.
So farmers and veterans are privileged people. If you try this with the Social Security Administration, you would not be able to.
Or food stamps. You apply for food stamps on such and such a day. If you don't meet the criteria on that particular day and time, at the end of your appeal, you can reapply the next day. But, you know, that application is dead and gone. It's got, like many of those kind of cases. I mean, that's the way it usually works. You get your control of the statute.
So USDA participants are in a privileged zone in this matter.
We have some questions on the website that we want to try to address.
Does correspondence among the agency and the OGC have to be provided to the appellant?
Well, it depends on what do you mean by correspondence, I guess. If it's getting a legal opinion from the OGC or something, no, the answer would be no. But if it's something that led to why they made a particular decision in a case, initially, then they would have to provide that. That's part of the decision-making process.
If you referred it to the general counsel for an opinion, and that was why your decision was rendered, that was included.
So, but if you're seeking legal advice or something, no, that's privileged information. You don't have to give that out.
Right. OGC has stated that the agency can settle with the appellant at any time up to and when the NAD decision is issued. This may be appropriate if the appellant presented new information at the hearing that we did not have access to and that the hearing officer would consider. Would you agree with OGC on this point?
basically OGC says you can settle at any time.
The short answer is yes.
Yes.
You can settle a case at any time, even after we issue a decision. So if we issue a decision that you have to reconsider the application, you can negotiate a deal with the other person.
Well, we have a...
It seems to say you can't do that. Well, we have a case recently where
the IG seems to say you can't do that. IG, okay.
IG told an agency, not yours, that they could not settle. But that was a different issue. That was a case where the IG...
IG didn't run our program.
So they claimed that they had decided something was an improper payment and that the agency must retrieve it and could not settle the amount that they retrieved.
Very interesting.
And the agency made a decision that here's how we think we can get the best money out of this deal and settle it, but IG said, no, you try to get all the money back. So, you know. But yeah, I agree with the answer. I think that's right. You can settle it at any time.
Are there any other questions from any of our state offices?
I have another one when you're here.
Yes, my name is Tammy. I'm in Washington. And maybe our CFRs have read that I've understood for over 20 years is that the adverse decision ties to certain points where we're making a decision, such as eligibility or approval or closing. And that's when we formally issue appeal rights or review rights on those situations. But we've had some cases where the applicant has asked for something that maybe is related to a form or something that they don't like in our policy, and we haven't issued formal appeal rights on that because it's not necessarily an adverse decision which would prevent them from receiving assistance. And I'm hearing you're saying that the definition is expanded, that just about anything can be appealed. But at what point should we be giving appeal rights? Because it's not necessarily stated in the CFR other than at those points of eligibility, approval, and closing.
Well, without knowing any of the details, I would say that what the statute says is that if you make a decision that the participant thinks is adverse, then he thinks that he can appeal it to that. The statute, again, remember, it's not the agency that provides appeal rights. The statute provides appeal rights. The agency provides notice of those rights. And so if you think about any adverse decision made by an employee of an agency has a statutory right, a participant has a statutory right to appeal that. Now, you also have to keep in mind that the person may likely lose, but that's irrelevant to whether he can come and talk to a hearing officer. I'm not looking at that kind of work because...
So previously, they would have 30 days after written notice was provided. Otherwise, they could appeal at any point, which would include after the loan is closed. So that's what my question is, you know, how do you get, you're just basically indicating that every time they ask for anything, the response should be in writing. There shouldn't be anything verbally.
Statute requires that if you make an adverse decision, if someone asks you for something and you tell them no, that you must reduce it to writing within 10 business days and tell them he can appeal it to that.
Within 30 days.
Right.
So any decision that's made, if you're going to take an adverse decision to an applicant, you're going to give them those appeals.
Right. You're going to notify him
in writing
of his statutory right
to appeal.
That's what the requirement is. There is no requirement that you tell people this is a matter of general applicability and you cannot appeal. There is no statute that or no regulation that says you should do that.
Are there other questions?
Hi, this is Jim Lavin from Massachusetts. I just a question on what I'm hearing and making sure I'm clear, but it sounds as though unless I missed something, that we are reacting to a decision that seems to be defined as a response to a request or an application, but we're going about our normal servicing duties and doing things that we have seen and implement or we're initiating it. I guess are we still, if they didn't ask for anything, we've already accommodated and got to a point where now something's wrong and we want to do it, something that will not be what they like. But is that something that we're talking about too?
Have to give me a little more detail about what you meant by that.
Well, if we're at, just say, for example, a case has already been obligated and the loan's kind of in a state where things are happening and we find enough. We want to do something now that stops the downward trend or stops what's happening. And we say, okay, we found out that there's been changes, there's adverse things that have happened in this situation. It's no longer something that we are wanting to participate. They didn't ask. We've already got to a point where we agreed to them and approved something, but now we're responsible for the funds. We're trying to manage the program, and we say there's something here that has emerged, which we now react to, and we now take the action as responsible for the program that stop. We're not going to continue. We're not going to do something that we have previously been going towards. And then it's not, they didn't ask. They have already, this is something that we have deemed as necessary to protect our interests and to keep the program protected. We're implementing something. Does that spark an appeal is what I'm just trying to make sure, in case of the wording that I'm hearing so far seems to be that this is something they ask, we say no, they appeal. Is that also what happens when we start it? We say that there's a change here, there's an adverse decision that we did in response to something that's happening in the case. Do we still have to notify them of appeal rights? Or don't we have any latitude to operate without always inviting this?
Bottom line is you're turning them down for a loan, right, because you think something's wrong with the process or the paper.
Correct.
Well, they've asked for a loan and you've told them no at some point. That would be a classic adverse decision.
Yeah, this is John Russo, and let me add to that. Let's say, give you an example. If you've issued a conditional commitment, and prior to closing this loan, the lender wants to modify or negotiate a change in that conditional commitment, they come to you with a proposal for that change, and maybe you feel you want to make additional changes to that commitment as well. Anytime you're going to issue an adverse decision to a customer, you're going to give them a appeal right. So even if you deny those changes to that commitment, you're going to give them those appeal rights.
Well, along those lines, too, I mean, if you could have, a request for like 10 or 15 different modifications, you may be okay with some of them and some of them you don't. Then obviously it's still going to have to be adverse because you didn't okay everything that they requested. And
possibly because of what they're proposing to change, you may want to modify some other change in that conditional commitment. All of those are options that they have appeals on.
But even if, and we've seen this kind of factual pattern before, you give a conditional commitment, and then you pull a credit report just before closing, and the guy's gone south on you. So you say, whoa, wait a minute, you're not meeting this condition, so we're not going to go forward with the loan. And that's an adverse decision at that point. And you must give him a
fine. That's an adverse decision. You give him those appeal rights.
We just very recently did a case where somebody wanted some kind of non-recourse language in a loan, and the agency said, well, we'll think about it, but we can't do it before closing. So the person went to closing, and then they asked the agency to do it. The agency said, no, we're not going to do it. They filed an appeal. We treated it as appealable, but the whole thing in the case ultimately wasn't adverse to the person because they agreed to all the terms of the contract that they went to settlement on. So it was not adverse.
Another question.
We are in a postponement of an appeal hearing to allow the applicant to provide an amended feasibility study. We just found out that in checking with the Secretary of State that the applicant was dissolved in May of 2012, so they can't do business in this state. What are their appeal rights now that they have been dissolved? Does the agency proceed?
That's a very complicated question.
Yeah. That sounds like it's a specific case, and it would be an ex parte contacting me to talk to you about that. Okay. And so refer that to the hearing officer.
Okay. Or discuss it with the agency, the situation, because we can possibly give you some guidance on that. But again, you know, you've got an issue here where you already got a, the hearing officer has set the parameters of the time frame of the hearing. We were involved in a case where a hearing officer postponed a hearing recently, but again, that's the decision and the discretion of the hearing officer. And so if it's to be postponed, that's an issue. If you find any other cases and differences in your case that's been presented, you know, it's something that to be presented at the hearing.
So turn out the way you like, we'll let you know what the answer is ultimately.
Right.
Also remember, the appellant has a right to a hearing within 45 days. The agency can't waive that. Only the appellant can waive that. And so you can't, you can ask for a postponement, but it's really up to the appellant. So it'd be good to talk to the appellant and explain why you need a postponement and see if they will waive their right to a quick hearing. And many times there is. We just had one where an agency rep had surgery. The appellant, of course, said, let's postpone the hearing for until it gets better.
Are there other questions?
This is Jen Lurch in Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island. I have a quick question. This is directed at NAD. If NAD does not support agency adverse decision based on fraud and misrepresentation of the lender, are we precluded, the agency precluded in any way from issuing a separate adverse decision on the basis of lender negligence later?
I'm not quite sure of your factual pattern, but my answer is that we determine whether a particular decision by the agency is erroneous or not. That doesn't preclude you, if we say that it was erroneous, from going back and issuing a new determination that is not all based on the same issues or facts that were found.
Okay.
So the answer might be, it's likely to be, sure, you can go back and redo it.
But if it did go to a hearing, any facts that were litigated in the first hearing that didn't change from one time to another, they're already going to be established in that case, so you can't necessarily relitigate those particular facts. But anything else would be fair game, essentially.
I mean, many times we see a case where a person comes in and has denied eligibility for something, and so he files an appeal, and he wins his appeal. He says, yes, he's eligible. And then the agency gets it back and says, okay, now you have to fill out the application. You have to go through the normal process. And the appellant says, no, but I won my appeal. I want my money. And the answer is, no, you have to qualify for the money.
Right, you're eligible to file an application, you know, but you're right. How does it qualify?
Oh, yeah. Are there other questions?
Okay, I have another question. More of an academic question, but let's say that the program has a rural eligibility requirement. You know how that's determined roughly. And you find that there's a city, let's say St. Louis, and it has a body of water, a lake, and it's, you know, in the city. Is that water rural or is that urban? If there was to be something that was to take place in the water.
Well, my immediate reaction would be, what do the program rules say about it?
Right.
You know, what our business is really to make sure the agency applies its program rules to its decision making. And so it depends on what program rules say.
And if there are no program rules and you're going to decide it one way or the other, you're going to have to come up with a rationale that seems to be in accordance with what rules there are and everything else that the program's supposed to be trying to do, and convince somebody at NAD that your interpretation
aligns
the rules with the correct one.
Yeah.
And it does get some deference.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. There are no more written questions. If there are no additional questions.
Hey, David. David, there is a written question here from New Mexico. Basically, can you guys discuss which regulation or the relationship among 1900V, 1940E, and 7 CFR Part 11
We note that 1940E isn't part of, or isn't referenced in 7 CFR Part 11.
And what would the result of that be? As I said before, no regulation issued by an agency can affect whether someone can appeal to NAC.
Yeah, unless it's short, as regs say.
But I don't know what 1900 says.
7 CFR would take the precedent first, and then RD instructions would fall under. Would that be correct? Would the statute 7 CFR Code of Federal Regulations would be on top? Agency regulations would be next. What about administrative notices? Do you consider administrative notices in an appeal?
Yes, of course. Those would be agency policy.
Those are the agency
or policy. Agency interpretation of statute.
Okay.
Or agency procedures that their employees are required to follow. So if you were issuing a handbook, it would have those kinds of parts. It would be an interpretation of regulations. There would be procedures that an employee is directed to follow. Let's say that an employee is directed to get the concurrence of his boss or signing something. Okay. The fact that he didn't get it, do it, doesn't mean that someone will win an appeal on that issue because it's not the process that's in the regulation. If you put it into the regulation, he may win.
If you, especially if you say it's like void if it doesn't follow these steps or something like that.
New Mexico, does that address your question?
Certainly does. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
This is Twan in Washington. I thought I heard you clearly say a few minutes ago that if the authority of NAD to determine if the agency decision was correct or not. I had not understood that when you make that determination that you can impose remedies. Could you clarify that? Because it seems that some of the decisions being made, it's not just a black and white, yes, the agency made a correct decision or not based on statute, but also there's some imposition of remedies by NAD, what the agency will do as a basis of their determination.
I mean, that is true in certain factual circumstances. For instance, the agency says, we're denying your application because it's late. We say it's timely, and we would say, therefore, you have to take the application. Right.
Well, what if, in a case, let's give you an example, if the appellant wanted to have something inserted into an agency form and the hearing officer found that we should, but that form has actually been vetted with legal counsel and OMB, does NAD have the authority to say that we must change our forms that have gone through the approval process?
Well, I have two questions about that. One is, it sounds like a case, and I don't want to really get into specific cases. But more importantly, have you appealed that determination to the director?
Yeah.
If you don't, you accept what the hearing officer says. Okay? Remember, you must implement it in that one particular case. That doesn't mean you have to change your form.
Well, but we've always been under the instructions from General Counsel that once those forms are cleared, that they should not be altered. And so, again, if we receive a decision like that, we would want to do X for the remedies.
I can tell you in one case not involving RD that the form that the farmer filled out was clearly wrong and the instructions didn't match the form, and neither one of them was correct, because it didn't get to the right result.
All right, we have another written question.
I have a written question. As it relates to the applicant's ability to provide additional information to the hearing officer, please confirm my understanding that new information can be provided as late as the actual hearing. Is the agency also allowed to provide additional information?
The answer to both of those are yes. And as I said before, if the appellant provides new information at the hearing officer should keep the record open a reasonable amount of time for the agency to rebut that or to make some comments about it. And usually that's a few weeks in what I see. So the answer to your question is yes, that could happen.
Are there any other questions?
This is Washington again. I'm curious what your opinion is about post-hearing briefs. Our regional OGC feels that we should be able to submit a post-hearing brief again up until the time that the NAD officer has issued their decision. Would you agree with that?
Well, it all depends. What was agreed to at the hearing about doing that? And what did the hearing officer say about it? And did somebody ask to leave the record open to supply a brief? And if so, what did the hearing officer rule on that issue? Those are the questions. And if the hearing officer says, no, I don't want it, it's not evidence in the case. You don't have an absolute right to do it. I don't know why they would necessarily say that. But, you know, if they did, well, then that's the end of that part of it. But that's all. Somebody would have to bring that up to the hearing officer when the hearing is getting ready to close and say, we want to submit a post-hearing brief and only 30 days to do it or whatever amount of time. And hearing officer would say, well, I'll give you 20 or no or whatever they say.
And let me add, don't work on a post-hearing brief unless you get permission to file it.
Right.
You know, ask for the permission first.
Right.
There is one point that I would like to clarify while you're here. In the event that the hearing officer decides in the appellant's favor and there is a request for director's review, the agency, RBS, it's my understanding, has 5 business days to file that, and only the administrator can sign that director's review. Is that correct?
The agency has 15 business days, 3 weeks, to submit a request for director review.
Okay.
Only the RBCS administrator can sign it, or someone acting in his capacity on the day he's gone.
Not just the assistant who wants a follow up.
Right.
The
acting on
the day.
Right. Well, my day's wrong, but I'm glad I got the point in.
Now, an appellant has 30 days, more days in which to file. You know, what can I say?
Somebody thought it was a good idea. Are there other questions from the audience?
Yes, this is Andres Aragon from New Mexico, and I have a question regarding the preferred method of notification. In the old Farmers Home days, we had format forms for, you know, appealable, reviewable, and non-appealable decisions, but it seems like as long as you're providing 30 days and allowing them to appeal, it doesn't have to be in any kind of format.
I think he was talking about the appeal. Is there a format?
Notification, yes, sir.
There's no form anymore.
No, there's no form that you have to follow. We are going to, by the end of the fiscal year, institute electronic filing of appeals, and we're going to start accepting documents electronically. So that will greatly help. I'm a little leery of taking administrative records or agency records electronically. A lot of our appellants just don't have the ability to deal with, you know, a CD with all these documents on it.
I guess where you're going, years ago there was a form when you first established in that division, there was a form to be signed. And now the direction's been given, we put it in a written format with the advice as to where to file.
There's no particular format. What's important to us are the elements of what's in the filing and not necessarily that's on a form.
Okay. We have another question. As it relates to circumstances demanding appeal rights, once an award has been made and the agency is servicing the account, in the event the agency becomes aware that covenants of the award are in non-compliance,
And am I to understand we would have to give the recipient appeal rights in our determination that the award is in non-compliance with their covenant?
I'm not sure of the facts to that, all the facts to that question, but if you're just advising them, for instance, that you're not in compliance, that would be one thing. If you're saying you're not in compliance, and because of that, we're going to somehow adversely affect your loan.
Accelerate the account.
Accelerate the account, yes, you would. Now, if you're just giving them advice saying you're not in compliance, you need to come in compliance, that would not appear to be adverse at that point.
But in the case, it would be like a non-monetary default if you would say you're going to accelerate it based upon that opinion, then you give them a feeling.
Right, you're right.
We've been very fortunate this afternoon to have Mr. Roger Kerfell and Mr. Jim Murray, both with the National Appeals Division, to spend part of their afternoon with us. And we want to thank both of them for taking time out of their busy schedule this afternoon to make their presentation. I would like, as a secondary note, that we'll have a second seminar or webinar on Wednesday, August 8th, beginning at 1 p.m., with Ms. Marjette Williams, who is a regional attorney out of our St. Paul, Minnesota office, will be providing some further NAD appeal issues and information to us. I want to acknowledge today Ms. Michelle Daniel and all of those rural development employees, as well as Ms. Sharon Phillips of NAD, who behind the scenes